Hello, you're listening to Microbe Talk, the podcast from the Microbiology Society. This month is the third episode of our podcast series, Domino Effect, where we introduce two microbiologists that haven't met before, and they talk about science, their careers, and, well, anything else that they want to.
My name's John Tregoning. I'm a reader at Imperial College London, and I work on respiratory infections.
My name's Sarah Jones. I'm a geomicrobiology PhD student. I'm split between Birkbeck Earth Sciences and UCL Structural and Molecular Biology.
Today, John is going to be interviewing Sarah. Stay tuned for their discussion on using microbes to mine minerals, science and comedy, and how to navigate those big career decisions at the end of your PhD.
So, Sarah, I'm an immunologist, so I don't know much microbiology. What is geomicrobiology?
It's looking at the interaction between microbes and minerals. So anything where bacteria or archaea or any other microbes, I guess, are interacting with mineral surfaces or geochemistry.
Are you measuring species level, or you said you're doing transcriptomics?
My supervisor, Joe Santini, she collected a sample of microbes from a mining site in Cyprus. And then what we've done is we've grown them up on copper sulfide minerals. And then after 8 and 12 weeks, and I think 16 weeks, I isolated the RNA from there. The bioinformatics work I'm doing at the moment is looking at what differences we see in terms of expression of things like sulfur metabolism or iron metabolism, whether different members of the consortium are expressing things more in the initial stages of mineral breakdown, or whether other members are taking over later on, or whether there's one player who's kind of dominating the whole process. We're pretty much trying to improve the model of how those minerals break down, with the aim of looking at making a bioleaching consortium that would be the most efficient at getting copper out of those minerals.
What is bioleaching?
It's the process of using microbes to mine metals out of minerals, so usually sulfide minerals. The minerals I look at are chalcopyrite, which is just copper, iron and sulfur. So if you get something that's sulfur oxidizing, the sulfur will be oxidized. If you get iron oxidizing microbes, the iron will be oxidized as well, and then the ferric ion will attack the mineral. The sulfur, which has been oxidized to sulfuric acid, will again attack the mineral, and then you end up, hopefully, in theory, with just the copper left over that you can then purify and use.
Going back a step, what was your personal path that got you into doing a PhD in geomicrobiology?
Yeah, it's a bit strange, really. I actually did an environmental science undergraduate degree, and I hadn't done any science A-levels at all, so which has proved very annoying and tricky over the years. People will mention things, they'd be like, oh, this was in GCSE biology, but I only took single science GCSE, so I don't know what people are talking about sometimes. But I did this environmental science degree, and then I really liked soil microbiology because I went to Reading, which is like a soil science specialist sort of university. And I really liked nitrogen cycling, so I was like a big fan of biogeochemical cycles. Did my degree, took a break for a year, did a master's in environmental management as well, which was kind of soil-based. Then I worked for a research company for a couple of years. And then when I was looking to do a PhD, I couldn't find a single place where I could find a PhD in nitrogen cycling, because that's what I really wanted to do. I did work for a couple of years before I did my PhD looking at soil contamination, and I worked for a research company. So I worked on a couple of projects there, one was a research project, which was a lab project looking at how compost and biochars can be used to clean up heavy metals from soils. And another one, which was looking at nanoparticles and the effects they might have on soils, or also whether they could be used to clean up contaminated land. And then, yeah, from the kind of research experience I had doing that, I thought, oh yeah, I'd like to go and do more. Because a lot of my work there was just doing literature reviews or proofreading and things. When I did that lab project, I thought, oh yeah, I really miss this. I'd like to get back into the lab. So I started looking for some PhDs then. And I could not find one on nitrogen cycling, which was what I wanted to do. So I looked at other things to do with pollutants or microbiology a bit more generally, and I applied for the London NERC DTP and I got onto it. and then while in the first term then, you could kind of talk to a bunch of people from across London's institutes, and I found Jo, who's an environmental microbiologist, and I got talking to her, and they said that we could build a project sort of looking at how microbes interact with minerals, and I thought that sounded quite cool. And I'd always kind of been interested in more molecular biology techniques, but I'd never really had much of a chance to work on them before. So, yeah, they suggested maybe I could do some RNA-based things during my PhD, and yeah, that's what I've done.
And so I guess the tricky question is, what next?
Yeah, it's a big question. So I obviously do some comedy on the side. I'm doing some freelance writing at the moment as well. I don't know whether my future might look a little bit like a patchwork of freelance jobs. I think I'd like to take a little academic break for at least 6 months or something, but I'd also be maybe interested in doing something public engagement based. Yeah, it's a it's a tricky question at the moment of exactly what I want to do. Maybe a part-time job and then some freelance work might suit me quite well.
So you mentioned the comedy. What do you do in that area?
I'm a stand-up comedian. Last year I was gigging a lot, which became very, very quickly unfeasible. There was a stage last year where I was sort of doing 3 or 4 nights a week where I was doing comedy gigs. So I got started in doing comedy about 3 years ago as part of my PhD programme. We have a specialist conference, which is just for our London NERC DTP. One thing they were running for that 1 year was a comedy night via the People at Science Show Off. And they wanted people who were attending the conference to be in it as a act. And one of the people from the staff on my DTP programme had seen an article I'd written like in a kind of comedic style. And she said, I think maybe you'd be good at this. Do you want to come and give it a go? And I was like, no, I could never be on a stage. That'd be horrendous. And she nagged me until I went to they did a training session and agreed to do that. And then I gave it a go at this conference and it went really well. I was asked, I think, to do another science show off in a more general setting. And then from there, people who've been in the audience of that have asked me to do Bright Clubs, and then eventually I ended up in what was called the Science Show Off Talent Factory, which was a public engagement and science comedy training program, which was funded by Wellcome, and it was run by Steve Cross. And I did that for a year, and through that I developed more general skills, and there were some like general comedians there, so I got started doing more kind of general comedy. And yeah, from then I've just kind of been asked to do a lot of things and ended up doing a lot. I went to Edinburgh last, so not the summer that's just gone, but the year before, and we did a special science show off there. And it's been very hectic for the last couple of years. I'm trying to not gig as much at the moment to try and finish writing up, which has been semi-successful because I'm very bad at saying no to things. It helps if you've got a specialism. So being a science comedian and also being Welsh, both of those have helped me a lot. I was recently asked to do something with BBC Wales, and I think that's literally just because my Twitter handle says Welsh comedian in it. And I think they searched for Welsh comedians on Twitter and just asked me to come and do something. And then science as well. There'll be people looking for science comedians to come and I emceed a corporate gig for a biotech company the other day. So that people like that will be looking for people who've got specialist knowledge that can make jokes about things that their company are interested in. That helps us getting paid gigs as well, that there are people looking for, who know a bit about both worlds, that can make jokes about what academia is like or what doing a PhD is like.
And has doing comedy helped you do your PhD?
Yeah, I'd say for sure, because when I first started my PhD I was extremely nervous about everything, and especially because I'd changed fields so dramatically. I didn't have a lot of self-confidence. I was constantly thinking, oh, I can't do that, I can't do that, I'm not capable of doing this. And then I obviously thought, oh, I could never get on a stage. And then I did it. And then I've done all sorts of things that I thought were terrifying. I thought, oh, I could never host a gig, and then I've done that. I could never run my own night, and then I've done that. So it's definitely helped me realise, if I think, oh, I can't do that, I probably can. And then obviously there's some transferable skills, like doing presentations. If you've stood in front of a festival crowd and had to tell jokes, it's not so scary to then go and give a talk about your research, because you'd think, well, these people don't need to laugh. I just need to show them my graphs. It's definitely made public speaking a lot less scary. And it's also, there's a a kind of thing where if a joke's going to work, you need to know what the audience know. Because if you tell a joke and they don't understand something about the joke, they're not going to laugh because they're missing part of the information. Or alternatively, if they know too much and they get to the punchline before you, they're not going to laugh because they've worked the joke out. So similarly, when you're giving like an academic talk, it's useful to know, like, to be able to think, what does the audience know? Because if I'm telling them something that's very simple to them, they're just going to switch off because it's boring. Or alternately, if they're missing some key information about something I'm telling them about my graph, then they're going to switch off because they just can't follow what I'm saying. So that's been a really useful skill to like help put me in the audience's shoes. So I think that's been a really useful skill to learn.
What's your best way of dealing with hecklers?
You don't get a lot of them in science comedy, actually. You get very nice crowds. The rules are always repeat back what the heckler said, number one, so that people in the audience have the context of what the heckler said, and also gives you a couple of seconds to think about what they said for a response. Yeah, it hasn't been too big a problem for me, luckily for me. The biggest problems you get in science gigs will be people heckling you corrections. So I've had, like, I did Blue Dot Festival before, and I made some joke about maths, and somebody heckled me the correct answer to a maths equation or whatever. Or I did I was hosting a science show off in Croydon where I was doing a quiz and I said something about the percentage of dark matter. And somebody from the audience heckled me, "Actually, we don't know the percentage of dark matter." You get a lot of that, and then I suppose you can just kind of make fun of the fact that people are such nerds in the audience that they heckle you facts rather than insults.
Do you think you could apply that to science talks? I guess you don't get heckling, but
yeah,
that's the questions.
True. I guess there's a lesson to be learnt from both, which is to not panic. Obviously, in a science talk, you can just respond, "I don't know," rather than have to, hopefully don't personally insult somebody at a conference in your field.
What's the value of public engagement? Why should people do it?
Before we're even doing research at all, I think it's important that we listen to what the public think we should be researching, particularly if research is being funded by public money. I think there's an argument that's very strong that the public should get a say in what their tax money is being spent on. And also, like, there's been so many huge science, like, debacles over the years, hasn't there? Like, the vaccine situation and GMOs is obviously a big one. I think if there'd been a lot more public engagement kind of upstream of GMO research, maybe the public could have engaged in a way that would have helped research develop in a way that the public would have been more comfortable with, and then there would have been less kind of media scaremongering, hopefully. You don't know, but that's like the classic public engagement example of reasons for upstream engagement. And then I think it's also important that if we're doing all this research, that people should know about it. We shouldn't keep information just to ourselves. There's a wider good in people knowing more science, I think. You know, there's a lot of space for two-way dialogue and doing that in an engaging way that people want, rather than a series of lectures. Or there's obviously huge gaps between the kinds of people who would come and see a talk at the Royal Society or the Royal Institute and the kinds of people who actually exist in society. I think one of the places that does this really, really well is Queen Mary, because they obviously know that they're based in a place that's very diverse, and there might be a lot of people from that community that might not necessarily go on to university campus. So they run a festival of communities which takes all of their academics out into the park instead, and they get people to engage with the research that's going on in Queen Mary in like a much more accessible way. That's something that people might do anyway. They might take their kids to the park on a Sunday anyway, and they're bringing academics to something that those people would be doing anyway.
I'm on the academic track, but that is one of hundreds of different jobs, and I don't think people always see that at the beginning of PhDs. It's not the most standard route that you've done, but lots of people don't do the standard route. So what advice would you have for somebody who's just starting their PhD about where it can take you?
It's introduced me to whole worlds I didn't even know about. So, yeah, I guess generally public engagement I wouldn't have come to unless I'd come via PhD. So I've also met so many different kinds of people. So I think that's been, I think maybe because I've been on a doctoral training program and we spent the first sort of 3 months just together, just doing lectures in different universities, it's meant I've met people from different academic fields that I never would have met before. I've ended up doing some podcasting and stuff, like obviously this, and then I've been on a few others, and that's introduced me to different people as well. Career-wise, it's sort of blown my opportunities and just expanded my concept of what jobs are available. Just like, it's just blown that out of the water because I didn't really know about public engagement before. And now, last year, I did some teaching about it.
I think people talk about somewhere between 95 and 98% of PhD students don't become academic. I'd see it as a positive thing because it's training people to go and do lots of other things. What piece of advice would you give yourself that you've learned?
It will come together in the end because a lot of my lab work went wrong. I was doing a different project for the first 18 months. We couldn't get the bacteria to grow. So, yeah, you will end up with some results, even if it seems like everything is failing. The results don't have to be perfect. They just have to exist. Generally, things that exist are better than things that don't exist. So start writing, even if it's terrible. Lots of people do this. So if other people have done PhDs, absolutely you can. There's no reason you can't. There's no need to think that you're not good enough because all sorts of people from all sorts of walks in life achieve it. And don't compare yourself to what other people are doing, because that'd be two people who have got 5 Nature papers in the first year for some reason, and then there'll be loads of other people who aren't talking constantly on Twitter about their success and are freaking out the same as you are. So it's fine, whatever pace you're going at, just keep going.
And that's all we have time for this month. We will be hearing more from John in the next episode of Domino Effect, when it will be his turn in the hot seat. If you would like to take part in a future episode of the podcast, do get in touch. I will leave my email address in the podcast description below. Thanks for listening to Microbe Talk.